Welcome back. Michael Warren Thomas here. It's the Grapevine on WISL 1040, 92.1 FM, and happy Mother's Day to everyone out there. Beautiful start to it with sunshine and not brutally cold. Chilly, but not as cold as it was a few nights ago. Not as cold as it's going to be perhaps tomorrow night. And the Finger Lakes vineyard owners and wineries are... They're concerned about the temperatures, and I saw a couple different postings from winemakers, vineyard managers, that it was close to potential significant losses, but probably not yet. It was fortunate that it was a pretty cold April, and so the buds are not as close to opening or quite opened as they might have if we'd had more normal April. And then these kinds of late frosts are much more damaging. So far, probably okay. It's a little hard to tell. They actually cut the buds and take samples and try to see if there's any brown layers in there that have died. But it's only been a couple days. I think that takes more than a day or two to show up. So, it may just be when the buds actually open up, they'll figure out whether or not there's been significant damage. And Gene Pierce from Glenora sends out his Glenora Gazette each Sunday. You can subscribe online to that for free. It's just sort of behind the scenes what's happening. He said that beyond the other projects in the vineyard, the below-freezing temperatures recorded early Friday and Saturday mornings, the coldest temperature recorded at Knapp and Glenora between 4 and 6 a.m. Saturday morning, when the temperature dropped to 27.8 degrees. And he says another factor, the temperatures were below freezing from midnight to 8 a.m. on Saturday. That's 8 to 9 hours below freezing. He says since bud break has not occurred in most Finger Lakes vineyards, we're in hopes that the freeze damage, if any, will be insignificant. And again, this Monday night is another potential cold one. They are we're projecting 28. Now it's still 28 and 30 degrees on Tuesday night, but it's really Monday night that looks to be colder, and again, that's the forecast. It can be colder than that, and that's also a Rochester number. That's not necessarily what it's like right near the vineyards, and that's why these lakes are so important. They moderate these temperatures, and so Glenora and Knapp was 27.8 degrees. If there were no lakes there, that might have been 24 degrees. It's just those few degrees of difference that make a world of difference in the potential damage to a vineyard. So in the spring like this, the lakes moderate the temperatures. They do a couple things. One, they slow down the buds from opening, so we get some really warm weather, and the lakes stay cool. It keeps some of the hillsides, areas closest to the lake, cooler. The buds don't open as fast, and then when these frosts come, invariably they do, there's not as much damage. But they also mitigate the frost to some degree, so it's not quite as cold as it would otherwise have been. And in the fall, it does the same thing. The early frosts, if we get a freeze in October, the grapevines shut down. Any ripening stops. It just closes them down. And again, if you can avoid those early frosts in the fall, it's just a night or two. It's just a few hours, usually. As he said, that first night, 4 to 6 a.m., Sometimes it's just, you know, 6 to 6:30 or something when it gets the coldest. And if you can avoid that in the fall, and you can avoid that in the spring, that's why these lakes are so important. So, again, areas away from the lakes probably were colder, and that's why we don't grow vinifera grapes that far away from the lakes, because we need those moderating temperatures in the spring and the fall. So two more nights of the winemakers, the wineries kind of pulling their hair out, and that's it's not just them, it's the orchards. Right now, a lot of the peaches, the apples, the cherries, these are all in bloom. And unfortunately, the cool weather slows down the pollination. The bees aren't as active. A freeze can just knock the fruit off these trees. Doesn't kill the trees, but you know, we don't have peaches every year or cherries every year reliably here in our area. And apples, generally we do, but some of these other apricots, very tender. So it's a critical stage right now, and we got to get through the next couple nights. So just a window into what farmers and, people in agriculture have to worry about, these spring frosts and freezes. We have a special guest with us. From Kombucha, it's Katarina Schwartz. Good morning, Katarina.
Hi, Michael. How's it going?
It's going very well. I'm loving the sunshine. And while you are not a winemaker, you do make a fermented product, right? You, if people haven't tried kombucha, you're based right here in Rochester. Maybe give them an introduction to what kombucha is.
Yeah, so kombucha is a fermented tea, so we are definitely in the same family with wine, cider, beer, mead, all sorts of fermented beverages. And kombucha is actually considered a non-alcoholic drink, so we're a little bit different in that regard. One of the things that determines alcohol content for your beverage is going to be the type of yeast that's used, and our yeast is naturally occurring within kombucha. It's a live active culture that we cultivate time and time and again, and it just doesn't really want to get alcoholic. So that's a main question I get about the drink. But in general, it's a fermented tea. You take tea, sugar, and the culture. Give it a period of, well, it depends on your environment, but maybe a week, 10 days. If you really like a punchy, sour kombucha, you may want to let it go for about 30 days of fermentation. By the end of it, you'll have this tangy, slightly sweet, and bubbly, non-alcoholic drink. It's a great substitute for sugary beverages, even caffeine beverages, because there is a small amount of caffeine in kombucha that comes from the tea. It can replace an alcoholic drink, and you can kind of do it seamlessly. So even if maybe you're wanting to partake in a social setting, but you don't want to consume alcohol, or maybe you don't want to consume the carbohydrates, whatever your reasoning might be, you can kind of do that pretty on the fly with kombucha and still feel like you're drinking something that's special, that's craft, that's, you know, it's a treat for yourself. But it's also good for you too.
And the idea of kombucha must go back a long way. So, what's kind of the history of it? Where was it developed?
Right. Well, so it's actually it's a pretty ancient drink. It's so ancient that we kind of don't know the exact origin of kombucha. We don't really know where the first SCOBY, which I can talk about a little bit, but the SCOBY is an acronym for symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast, but it's the name for the culture. We don't really know where that first came from. There's research that shows that kombucha was first discovered in 221 BC, And there's actually a brand that calls themselves 221. So, you know, there's some lore in that. There's some lore in this Dr. Kombu, who would prescribe a tea to his patients. And back then, this was, you know, more of like not a witch doctor, but, you know, some sort of like alchemist person. And, you know, but there's also sources that maybe it came from, you know, Russia. And Russians have, and the whole Eurasia kind of region has a drink called kvass, which is spelled K-V-A-S-S, and that is usually made out of sourdough or rye, but also can be made with beets. It's another fermented drink. So anyways, that's all to say is that it has a lot of deep roots in Asia and Russia, but we don't exactly know where it came from. We do know that it's an extremely old fermentation style.
And you mentioned the sourdough rye in Russia when you were mentioning the yeast Kibosh. And things. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was thinking about, you know, sourdough starters that people are feeding every day and making their sourdough bread out of. That sounds like what they were doing in Russia.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to, and pardon me because I'm really not an expert on kvass. But I would have to assume that it probably comes from regions that are not economically blessed, and they may have stale bread, and they're looking for ways to kind of zhuzh it up and make it into something,
sure.
You know, better. And so usually, yes, it's from like a kind of a stale, and I mean, When a bread goes stale and it starts to culture itself and get moldy, you know, I don't think you'd use moldy bread, but, you know, it's kind of mold and yeast and fermentation. They're all brothers, you know, so it's kind of a way to preserve your food and make it last a little longer.
And beyond things like, you know, coronavirus and those types of negative microorganisms, it seems like kombucha has come to the forefront once again at a time when we're learning more about all of the microbes that are in our guts, the microbes that are on our skin. People are writing about them, they're thinking about them, and maybe we're becoming more just better able to handle the idea of that not all microbes are bad, right? You know,
we're becoming woke to microbes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're totally right. And I think it's even, like you said, it's pre-COVID-19. I think kombucha has been sort of, I don't think it started necessarily the awareness of microbes, because there was, before kombucha, I think people were pretty understanding of a probiotic, even if they didn't fully get what was happening with their own, what's called microbiome, which is your own collection of microbes. But I definitely think that the advent of kombucha, of sourdough, other great, delicious, and trendy ferments like sauerkraut and kimchi, all of those really kind of educate the consumer on what they're consuming. And kombucha is not the first beverage to do this. I mean, I've known on your show you talk about wine, you talk about coffee. I mean, you're really an education-based show, so I'm sure your listeners are, you know, they're interested in being educated, if not already pretty educated on the subject. But yeah, you know, one of the things I talk about, I give classes on how to make your own kombucha from home. Because like sourdough, it's an easy thing to make from home, you know, in general. Not everyone's going to be amazing at it, just like not everyone is an amazing bread maker, but it's possible. And one of the things I try to express to the students that I have is this idea of your microbiome and why it's important to surround yourself with microdiversity. And kombucha is a great way to do that. Not only are you cultivating these cultures in your kitchen, in your home, where they're, you know, surrounding you, but you also get your hands into it too. You know, that gets onto your skin as you're drinking it. Obviously, that's going to help to re-diversify what's happening on the inside. There's a lot of benefit to even just having the kombucha in the home before you even drink it.
But, you know, I grew up in, not necessarily recently, but, you know, the last 30 years, all of our, you know, disinfectants and, antibacterial soaps kind of, you know, told people that microbes were bad, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And we're maybe starting to move away from that a little bit more, and kombucha is helping people to do that because it is, it's alive, right?
Yes.
The process,
so
kind of?
The kombucha is alive, and when you make it at home, you can really see that because you start with one culture, the SCOBY I was talking about earlier, your symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. Now, kombucha is not the only culture, not the only fermented drink or ferment in general that has SCOBY. Technically, sourdough starter is also considered SCOBY. But we've kind of co-opted the name for that, for our culture. But people call it the mother or the mushroom, although I feel compelled to tell your listeners that kombucha is not a mushroom. But
right.
It is kind of like a just a nickname that some people would use, I guess, for their SCOBY. I'm sorry, I'm getting a little distracted.
That's
my
right.
Own wandering.
The SCOBY, how does that originate? You know, you're about to start your first kombucha you've ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the SCOBY come from?
Right. So that kind of goes back to my my little history blurb before, which is that we don't really know where the first SCOBY comes from. In general, most people get SCOBY from another person who has SCOBY. So another awesome thing about kombucha and fermentation is that it's so educational and so community-based. You know, you learn how to make these things either from a parent or a neighbor or a friend, or, you know, it's awesome. It creates a community of people who are like-minded this way. But so generally you would get a SCOBY from someone else. Like at Kombucha, I sell the SCOBYs, and they come with the class if you get the class, that kind of thing. If you wanted to grow your own SCOBY, one way to do that would be to take some kombucha that's already been made. So you could go and get kombucha somewhere, and you would leave it out on the counter, open to the air. Of course, you want to cover the opening with something that would prevent flies or dust or something from getting in. So a finely woven cloth, a paper towel, a coffee filter, something like that. You leave it on your counter for a couple of days, and you'll start to see at the top that, you know, something will be starting to form, and it starts as like a little film. It gets like iridescent kind of, and then it'll start to get thicker and thicker, and that's your SCOBY. So the secret really is that the entire liquid of kombucha is actually SCOBY, because yeast and bacteria live in symbiosis inside the drink itself. And then what we call SCOBY, which is like the cellulose, the little gelatinous mat that sit on top, that, you know, they're really the same thing, but it's really a byproduct of fermentation. That comes from, you know, if you've heard of the term survival of the fittest, right? So this is a living drink, and it is trying to protect its insides from bugs and dust and other bad microbes from entering. So it actually creates the cellulose on its own to protect what's underneath. So the SCOBY is actually That little mat on top is actually just a byproduct of fermentation to protect what's inside. So, it's a little complicated to kind of wrap your head around that part of it, but you can, to get back to your original question, you can grow your own scoby from, you would want to use like raw kombucha, which is what we make, and what several other local brands make as well. Ones you would want to stick away from are, really the main one you wouldn't want to use is Kivita. And that's just because it's not a traditional kombucha, traditional ferment.
What is a Kivita?
Kivita, yes, it's a brand of kombucha that's widely sold. And you can get it, people buy it often because it's pretty much the cheapest. And a lot of people don't know if they want to try kombucha, so they're not going to necessarily go for the $6 bottle right away when they can say, maybe I'll buy this, you know, $1.95 bottle to see if I like it.
Right.
And
that's like buying, you know, the cheapest beer to see whether you like beer.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm not trying to throw shade on another brand, and not even in really the same category as the rest of us producers of kombucha locally, or even some of the other bigger kombucha brands are natural and raw as well. So there's other options is what I'm trying to express than one that's a little bit of an imposter of kombucha.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's a mass scale production also that's different than a craft beverage.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even if you choose one of the larger kombuchas, it's the difference between getting a mass-produced beer that's like a mid-level beer, like let's say like Ballast Point or something, right? Let's keep it local. Our Constellation Brands owns Ballast Point, but it's a big mass-produced beer, and it's still pretty good, versus getting your local beer and spending a few bucks extra, like a Rohrbach beer or something like that. And you know, there is a difference that you can taste and that you feel also as a consumer.
That's great timing to mention Rohrbach's. That's where you're located, right near them, right on Railroad Street.
Yeah, I mentioned them because they're great friends, and I know you're friends with them too. But yeah, so. Kombucha is located in the same building as Rohrbach and Black Button. We're run back. We have a production space back there that's very small. It's less than 500 square feet. But it's like our incubation space, and we've been there this whole time. On Saturdays we open up for the market. 9 to 2 in the parking lot there, so people couldn't find us there, and we do growlers and that kind of thing. So I do have some retail outlet due to the coronavirus and the shutdown. I'm doing also pickups for curbside pickup there on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And they've been incredible friends, Rohrbach and Black Button. They've been incredible friends, very helpful. And big promoters of my stuff and me. I don't know that I would have been where I am right now if it wasn't for John Erlab, the owner of Rohrbach, who is just such an incredible giving person. And with all this being said, I do have a space in the works that I'm planning to move to, because we're outgrowing our space, and I want to offer more of a permanent retail option for my customers. And for, you know, it's good to interact with who you're selling to. So we're actually moving not that far across the street to 106 Railroad Street. So we're at 97. We're moving to 106. And that'll be a little bit, since all construction is basically on hold right now. But it's coming, and, you know, hopefully there'll be a lot of pomp and circumstance when it's open.
Yeah, a band to lead you across the street, right?
That
a marching
would be nice.
Band.
Maybe not me, but you know, could have all the Scobies in a
That's
parade.
Right. So, do you? While we're on the topic of Scobies, do you have different ones for different products that you make, or is it really all based on kind of the original one?
So, it's a little bit of a complicated answer, but in general, I keep. In general, if it's tea that I'm using as the base, which is Camellia sinensis, is the formal name, then those I kind of let go with whoever I'm using tea with, whatever flavors I'm using tea with. Now, some flavors I do, I use tisanes in them as well, which a tisane is like a tea that's not Camellia sinensis. So, like hibiscus, rooibos tea is a flower. Mate comes from a root plant. So those I would keep separate from my Camellia sinensis. So Camellia sinensis teas are like green, you know, the basic terms are green, white, black, you know, but, I've got like a Sencha green tea, oolong tea, an Assam. The collaboration I did with Joe Bean, which I know you guys talked about a month ago, that's all a Camellia sinensis based tea with a white peony and an Assam tea. So, sorry, it's a little bit of a complicated answer, but in general, I try and keep the Scobies with the teas I'm fermenting, unless it's all the same, like Camellia sinensis base.
And you mentioned the collaboration with Joe Bean, and you hopefully be producing more of that once the shutdown ends. How did that come about? What was the idea of combining coffee and kombucha?
Well, so you know Kathy, and I'm sure your listeners do too. She's just such a force. That's such a positive
good word
force.
For her.
And when I met her, I mean, we were both like, I know you, but like, I don't know you. You know what I mean? And so we kind of had this really fast, awesome friendship. And she's really been a mentor to me in that, you know, she really sees a lot of similarities in what she did and what she brought and what I'm doing and what I'm bringing. And so that really opened up this kind of trust and mentorship between the two of us, to collaborate openly, and just see, we were just like, you know what, even if we don't do anything together, we still have this awesome collaboration as friends and as, people who are, trying to bring awareness to a unique product that is, we're trying to make a change in the way people think about beverage in our town. So even if we didn't make a collaboration, but we thought, you know, let's experiment, let's try, let's see if people are even interested, you know. So it really was a slow kind of start. We did some trials with different teas and different coffees, and her son, Ben Turiano, and I, and Andina was there to help to taste test. And, you know, so, you know, blah, 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 all that happened. we found a recipe we liked. We did a tasting of it that was free and open to the public. And we said, just let us know what you think. Are you guys into this? You know, and we had a lot of, you know, people come out, and a lot of foodies were definitely interested. And it was great. And, you know, I have to say, it's not, the flavor itself, I think, is delightful. I think it's juicy and fruity, and, it has all the notes of coffee in it without being like roasty, and it's more juicy. So I really love that about the drink, but I will say that it's probably not every coffee flavor's, or sorry, every coffee drinker's cup of tea, and it's probably not every kombucha drinker's cup of coffee. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's great. I think it's a good collaboration. I think we didn't try to make coffee into kombucha. We didn't try to make kombucha into coffee. We
exactly.
created something new, which is why we decided to give it its own name. So we're creating this series that's called Imbue, which means to infuse or to put together, which I kind of came across that word. It's like one of those words where I know I've heard it before, but I don't know where. And then as soon as I decided to call it this, it's like I can't stop hearing people say the word, but they're not talking about my drink. They're just talking about it. So, you know, so we did this collaboration, and then honestly, we released it. It was the first 2 weeks of March, so perfect timing on our part, of course. And yeah, so now we're in a shutdown. I will say, for anyone who's interested, I believe Joe Bean has some bottles left, and I definitely have some bottles left for sale. They're on my website for pickup. So if anyone does want to try this, you can check that out. And we're definitely going to do more. It's just it's a question of when, it's more of a question of when, because I think that this product line will be more prevalent once we're all not feeling the stress of this shutdown. So,
if the website is katbucha.com. Katarina yeah. Schwartz is with us, and so it's KatBoocha, katbucha.com. And the one of the things that you highlight in your website is the health benefits, not for everyone, but just the microbes that are in kombucha can be very beneficial for some people, and it kind of helping to maybe rebalance the microbes in our guts?
Yes. So one of the things I definitely like to put out there right away is that I'm not a doctor, and I'm not a registered dietitian, and I can't give anyone health advice. You know, I can't say, yep, this is definitely going to do this for you. But what I do have on my website is some anecdotal, story of my own story and how I even found kombucha, and it's, spurred essentially this business, which is to, if people go on, you can read about my story that I had some gut health issues, and they were kind of came out of nowhere. I wasn't sure why, it happened when I was in my early 20s. I was a vegetarian. I was an active person. There's no real reason for me to have been struggling so bad. And that's basically when I went to see a specialist about it. And I come from a family of doctors. So my inclination was, okay, I need to see a specialist because there's something wrong with me. I need to know, what's going on. I'm very much minded that way, where I like to know the science behind something, of why my body is acting the way it is. And, full disclosure, some of my other family members have the same issue. And I think I was thinking, I don't want this to be the start of the rest of my life with this issue, because I saw what it's doing to them. So, and that specialist was great. She told me that she doesn't understand, and most people don't understand, why 20-somethings and 30-somethings have IBS. But essentially, they think it's linked to stress. And one of the great benefits of kombucha, other than its microdiversity, is that it's a huge wealth of B vitamins, B12 especially, which is something that is hard for vegetarians to get in their diet naturally. So, the microbes also, like we've been talking about, they help to rebalance the gut with healthy microbes, which essentially makes digestion go smoother. And some people worry that if they have a kombucha, their digestion will go very quickly if you catch my drift. But it's not like that necessarily. It's more that things kind of get normalized. And yeah, I've definitely noticed the difference. I pretty much don't have any problems anymore in that regard. And I think a lot of people do come to kombucha or fermented foods and have a very similar experience. I mean, not everyone is the same. And there are other outlying factors as well that go into everyone's specific situation. But, you know, I put that out there to kind of explain to people why I'm even doing this and give some anecdotal truths about myself to show people that I'm for real. Like, I really believe this, and I really believe in kombucha, not just because it's a great alternative to soda or a beer, you know, for the sheer nutrition of it, but because I actually think it improves my life.
And the, again, kombucha, as you said, some of the ones that are marketed, they're inexpensive. They are you know, mass produced. And I would guess that it's the living culture that you lose when you have to mass produce something and, you know, store it for months or ship it worldwide, et cetera. Is it the living culture that's part of the key?
Yeah, so you definitely want to look for brands that, so this is a great question, and I'm sure people are want to know, how do I tell when I'm at the grocery store what brand is for real and what brand is not? So one of the things you want to look for when you look at the back panel, as far as cultures go, if they have added cultures, so sometimes they'll say, you know, they'll make claims like, you know, 2 billion cultures of X, or, you know, if you see that, generally that means that that brand has put in artificial probiotics. So that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not traditional kombucha. I mean, it's altered, but it doesn't mean that the fermentation process maybe have been different. It just means that this brand has decided that they want to beef up the probiotics that are in the drink naturally. And if that's something you're looking for, I mean, that's your prerogative. I don't add probiotics to my drink because I know I don't think it needs it, you know. But then again, you know, some people may want like that added probiotic. So there's that to look out for. Doesn't necessarily mean that it's not that the cultures are dead, but it also could mean that the cultures are dead. Okay, so here's the next sort of thing to look out for. If the product is not refrigerated, which I haven't seen much here, but it's more popular in other places, then it's totally artificial. I mean, it could have been made as kombucha, but then they pasteurize it, so they kill off all of the good guys in there, and then they put in, like, artificial probiotics. So that is something to steer away from. Another thing you want to maybe look out for not necessarily microbes, but you want to look at the added sugars. If someone has put on that they have an added sugar of, you know, 20 grams or something like that, I mean, that basically means that after fermentation, they've put in sucrose, table sugar, to sweeten it up. That's not going to be good for you health-wise. And on the point of sugar, this just came to me as I was talking. If the only sugar source in the kombucha is stevia, which I think some I've seen, then that is a first indication that what you're drinking is not fermented, because stevia is not a sugar source. It's a plant, yes, but it it doesn't, it's not sugar. It's not sucrose. So in your culture, the way that kombucha works is that the culture feeds on the sugar in the tea. That's their food source. So if you have stevia, which flavors things as sugary without having actual sugar content, that right there is an indicator that, you know, what was the food source then, you know, if there wasn't any sugar? And it needs, it's not like you could substitute it for something that doesn't contain sugar.
You can actually grow stevia in your garden. I have. It's a green plant, and I've taken it to classes that I've done on garden club presentations, so people can take a bite of a leaf. It's fun. You should get a stevia and grow some. It's just an annual, so it'll die if you don't bring it inside or dry the leaves. But it's 200 times sweeter than sugar by volume, and people's eyes just pop open when they take a bite of this green leaf, because it's so sugary. But I never thought about the point of you know, whether anything could ferment with it. That makes perfect
sense.
Yeah, so
you can't. Well, you could flavor with it, right? But you couldn't use it as the sugar source. So you know, marketing trends and trends in the market really dictate how people produce things, right? So a big trend with kombucha, or you know, kombucha drinkers, I should say, is that they're healthy. They don't want to consume sugar, you know, the whole 30, the keto, you know, with carbohydrates. So producers are looking for any way to give themselves an edge and say, oh, guess what? My product contains zero sugar, you know. And then the rest of us are kind of like, really? Really?
How does
you
that
know,
work?
What are you making? So, and right now, just a little bit of insider baseball. There is no definition for what kombucha is. So that is why if your listeners are like, well, geez, how can like all these people make kombucha, but you don't know which one's really traditional kombucha or not? There is no definition through the FDA of what kombucha is. So, and that's something that our professional group, Kombucha Brewers International, KBI, has been working on for literally years, because the reason being is because there's so much in our community that differentiate with each other.
hopefully
that's forthcoming.
You want to protect the brand. I mean, it's like ice wine producers, you know, protecting that word by, you know, it has to mean it's being produced out in the field and not frozen in a freezer. You can't call it ice wine. It's you know, why people in Champagne don't want you to call a sparkling wine in the United States champagne. It's, you want to protect that word kombucha so it means something. Otherwise, it can be anything.
But there's big players at play. So that's the, you know, it's actually quite interesting, but there's big players at play. Last year I went to Kombucha Con. Yes, we have that, and it's awesome. And it's in California every year, and I would say that hopefully a lot of your listeners are familiar with GT's kombucha, which is the Synergy brand. I mean, it's pretty much everywhere, and it's one of the first kombucha brands that went national. So this guy, GT, he's the founder. I mean, he's kind of an icon. He came and talked, and he's donating $1 million to our organization to help us come up with a definition. Now, donating $1 million, though, don't you think would sway it to how he wants it to be? And luckily, I would say most of us small producers agree with what his philosophy of kombucha is. So that's the good thing. But there's big players at play. That the other big brand I mentioned earlier, Kavita, is owned by Pepsi. And you better believe that they're threatened by us wanting to you know, make this definition of kombucha to, you know, have it say that it contains live cultures. It's from tea, sugar, and culture. It's not pasteurized. It doesn't have added probiotics. There are certain things like that, you know, would really threaten them. But It's a saga, you know. If anyone's interested in beverage news, like a beverage junkie like me, there's a lot of articles out there, especially on BevNet. So,
yeah. Katarina Schwartz is with us. Kombucha.com is the website. And a couple final things you didn't mention. How long does kombucha stay on your refrigerator? Let's say, you know, someone picks them up from you, one of your pickup days there on Railroad Street. How long does it stay in the refrigerator?
Okay, great question. So all of my kombuchas, other than the growlers, I would say, because those are kind of bottled on site. But all my bottled kombucha has a best by date or a use by date on the bottom. So if anyone gets one of mine, you can always check that. But in general, kombucha is, because it's a fermented food and because I'm doing a natural fermentation, it doesn't really go bad ever. It's never going to get moldy. The one thing that will happen, over time is that the culture will continue to consume whatever residual sugar is left. And actually, there's usually very little. So if all the sugar gets consumed, you know, at that point, it gets pretty vinegary. So the one thing, if you crack open a pretty old kombucha, it'll just maybe taste a little bit vinegary than you thought it would. But in general, they're not going to go moldy. So you can kind of, you know, feel good about that.
And we talk about wines being dry, semi-dry, sweet. It sounds like basically the kombucha gets drier with time in the bottle a little bit.
Right.
As you said, there's maybe not a lot of sugar in it. But do you have different levels of sweetness in the kombuchas that people can buy?
So when I make my kombucha flavors, I'm always going towards flavor, and I'm not, you know, I'm not at the beginning of the process thinking, oh, great, I'm going to make this one 10 grams of sugar. You know, it's always going towards the flavor. So in general, though, some of my kombuchas contain, they have it's not necessarily a second fermentation, but I flavor them with real fruits and or roots sometimes. So, like the grapefruit lavender, and right now I have out a strawberry cacao, so that has strawberries. And for those of you who are thinking, where does she get strawberries? They're from last season, but they're from a local farm that I've froze fresh. So I'm trying to move through some of that. But anywho, so those have a little bit higher of a sugar content because the sugars aren't necessarily added afterwards. I'm not adding table sugar in, but there is a little bit of sugar from the fruits that I'm putting in that are contributing to the fermented tea, you know, where it was before flavoring it. So the ones that have the least amount of sugars are going to be ones without any added fruit for my kombucha. In general, the sugar can range between 3 grams and 6 grams of sugar per serving for my kombuchas.
All right. And again, people can order online, and what's the pickup schedule for that?
Yeah, so people can order online. You can get their kombucha.com. We talked about it a little bit earlier, KATBOOCHA.com. And there's a button right at the beginning that says pickup. So you can hit that. Tuesdays and Thursdays are pickup between 10 and 1:30 at Kombucha on Railroad Street. And then I have Saturdays from 9 to 2. So I know everyone's schedules are, you know, a little bit different nowadays. I wanted to kind of give a couple of options there for people.
All right. And again, so pre-order only at this point. And again, a fascinating beverage. You start learning about this category, and you learn a bit about history, about microbes. And I sort of came at microbes from a soil level, and you were mentioning one of the brands put in 2 billion microbes, and that sounds impressive to people because they don't realize how tiny that amount of 2 billion is.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
These microbes are so tiny, and we still really don't have a concept, most people, of what microbes do. So when I tell people, you know, in a teaspoon of soil, there are maybe 4 billion microbes, they just,
wow,
they don't believe you,
right,
because it just looks like dirt. I mean, that's not alive. It's just dirt.
There's a great book if people are interested, and I think it's easy to read, and you know, it wouldn't be beyond your readers. It's called The Mind Gut Connection by Emron Meyer. He's a doctor, Dr. Emron Meyer, and he talks about your microbiome as the forgotten organ, and he says if you are able to take out all of the microbes from your skin and inside your body, like all your whole microbiome, put it on the table, it would be the size of your liver, which is crazy to people because you don't think about that. But they are on you. You just can't see it, and they're in you.
Well, and also, in terms of the soil, they're organized, but we can't. It doesn't look like it's organized. We can't, you know, like your liver looks organized, your skin looks organized.
Right.
But
exactly.
All those microbes that are in our guts don't look organized. They're just, you can't see them. All the microbes in the soil, they are actually, they're organized. And that's why rototilling is not necessarily the best idea, because there's an organization in that soil. We just don't understand it very well. We can't see it. And the same is true of the microbes in kombucha and our guts. So it's a fascinating mm-hmm. world to explore, and it's kind of ironic that one of these microbes is wreaking havoc on the planet right now,
mm-hmm.
Because there mm-hmm. are there's some bad microbes out there, but wow, really most of them are incredibly beneficial and just essential for life. If you got rid of your microbes, you wouldn't last long.
You couldn't live without your microbes.
Right.
You know.
Right. Katerina, lots of fun to talk to you about kombucha. And again, based right here in Rochester, look her up at kombucha.com, and looking forward to time when you can do some classes again. You did them through the Rochester Brainery, right?
Yes. And I actually, if you don't mind if I self-plug this, but I do have a class coming up with them for a week from today, from the 17th of May, and it's through Zoom. So I'll send you the starter kit, and you can make it along with me. You also can have the option to pick up your starter kit if you want to save a couple extra bucks.
And people sign up through Rochester Brainery?
Rochester Brainery. Also on my website, there's a classes and events tab, and it's there as well.
All right, so May 17th, again, you'll do this from home via Zoom, but you have a number of days in which to pick up the kit or have it shipped to you. Maybe friends or family would want to do this with you, and the kits can be shipped to various locations or picked up. So glad you mentioned that. Thank you very much.
I'm glad you did, actually.
Well, the specific class coming up this soon, people might want to try delve into it more. So thank you for all your time this morning. I really appreciate it, and enjoy this beautiful day.
You too. It was really great to talk with you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's Katerina Schwarz, and founder of Kombucha. She said she's doing a Zoom class. If you want to delve into it and actually have the kombucha in front of you during that class, great way to do it. And KATBOOCHA, kombucha.com. We'll take a quick break. Be back after a word from our sponsors here on The Grapevine.
Tiny bubble. bubbles. Make me warm all over with a feeling that I'm gonna love you till the end of time. So here's to the golden moon.
Welcome back. Michael Warren Thomas here with the sponsors of The Grapevine. Those include Eagle Crest Vineyards, which is just above Hemlock Lake. A gorgeous setting, and they've been doing Saturdays, big sales on Saturdays. That's D-A-Z-E, Saturdays sales, and great bargains on cases of wine. If you want to stock up for summer and have some local wine, it's quite a range of wines at Eagle Crest, from Mosel-style Riesling to Unoak Chardonnay, Cabernet Franc, some really good blends, dessert wines, some fun labels. There's a lot to explore from Eagle Crest. And again, Saturdays are the days that they're open for curbside pickup. Right now, you can contact them, order online. They have a new website for ordering pure wine online. And it's, again, Eagle Crest Vineyards. .com to get more information. They were founded by Bishop McQuaid back in 1872, so incredible history. And Will Aline, the winemaker owner, has been working to preserve that history, but also looking to the future, renewable energy. So they want to power the winery with renewable energy, and they have a large solar array now and have for quite a few years in the field next to the winery. It's EagleCrestVineyards.com. Also brought to you by Herd Orchards, and they had a special Mother's Day basket and box that could have been shipped. They sold out of, but they'll probably be doing something similar for Father's Day. And the way Herd Orchards packages things, it's just gorgeous, and it really gives you a sense of nostalgia for the farm, the history of the farm, which is over 200 years old. And some beautiful products. And, of course, they've got frozen apple pies available. By Father's Day, they'll probably have far more than that as they begin to open for the season in May. It's herdorchards.com to get more details. Route 104, just west of Brockport. And it's a fantastic farm. If you've never been, look them up online. Get some details. Read about it. And plan to pick up some of their pies in the near future. Also brought to you by Ristorante Lucano for some outstanding Italian food. They're doing takeout. This is not Italian-American, but more true Italian food with an Italian wine list. All Italian except for one wine that's from the Finger Lakes. And so if you want to explore Italian wine during this shutdown period, get some food and some wine from Lucano. It's ristorantelucano.com. And this November, Chuck and Joanne Formosa, the owners, will celebrate 20 years of the restaurant being open. That's ristorantelucano.com, the corner of East Avenue and Winton. And you can order takeout at ristorantelucano.com. And finally, brought to you by Arrowhead Spring Vineyards, Western New York. They are doing a curbside pickup as well as shipping wine, and they can ship to many states if you want to send some wine just to family and friends. It's arrowheadspringvineyards.com. Just an hour and a half west of Rochester, north of Lockport. Pretty drive this time of the year with all the apple orchards, cherry orchards out that way. And you can do curbside pickup, or also they can ship. They're doing a lot of dry reds, and their Cabernet Franc, Syrah, are just amazingly rich wines. It's Got to taste them. Get a maybe a sampling of 6.5 case or a full case. And they also do delicious white wines. ArrowheadSpringVineyards.com. When you call and visit our sponsors, tell them you heard about it here on The Grapevine. Oh, Michael Warren Thomas here. It's the Grapevine. Stay tuned for hour number two. We'll talk with Scott Osborne from Fox Run Vineyards here on WYSL 1040.